Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gina Scott, and today is August 11th. Or not 11th, today is the 18th, 2009, and this is episode 320. Tonight we have a very interesting topic, and we're challenging a taboo that is very ingrained into the average American's mind regarding their own soul, the sanctity of their own body as a shell that only their soul should ever occupy. It's a subject of possession. We're going to be looking at it in a very different way than mass media typically addresses it. That's not doing The Exorcist or explaining some vile crime by using possession as an explanation. The book is called Drawing Down the Spirits, written by Kanaz Filan and Raven Caldera, both with long experience outside of the mainstream American religions. Because of the volatile nature of the topic, we're also not going to use phone lines to take questions. Well, we're going to take questions from the virtual auditorium or via email. You can email me at gscott@gmail.com, and I'm monitoring my email during the show. More information is also available at www.exogenynetwork.com as well. So, everybody, let's explore some new ideas and see what we think. And welcome Kanaz Filan and Raven Caldera to the Dawn of Shades. Kanaz, I suspect I slaughtered your last name again.
No, you actually did fine. I answered almost anything that's not obscene.
Ah, yeah.
It's
well,
Kanaz, so Kanaz Filan, but Filan, Filan, it all works for me.
So why don't you go ahead and go first, since I tortured your last name, and tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Kanaz Filan. I am Ungan Sipwen. I'm an initiated junior priest in Haitian voodoo. I have been studying voodoo for about, at this point, 15 years. I have been an initiate in voodoo for about six. I have written several books on the topic. I am the author of The Haitian Voodoo Handbook. I am also the author of Voodoo Love Magic and the forthcoming Voodoo Money Magic. And I wrote Drawing Down the Spirits with Raven because we had an interest in transpossession. Both of us, both of us had experienced transpossession. We realized there was very little available on the market that was written about transpossession by people who actually had experienced it. And, you know, when I found out that there was somebody else who was working with it, who was not necessarily coming at the issue from the Afro-Caribbean angle, it's, you know, at the time, possession is very well known within African traditions. It's well known within African diaspora traditions. I had met Raven at a gathering, and I discovered he was working with possession, and, you know, he was doing it from the northern tradition, from a Scandinavian Germanic standpoint. And then I was like, oh, so this exists elsewhere. Then we started doing research, and we found out that it would be easier to list cultures where transpossession didn't occur than where it had, than the cultures where it had. It was much, much more common than we had thought. And, you know, I think I will go over to Raven about that, and he can explain some of his experiences.
Hi, hi, Kanaz, and hi, yeah. All right, yes. I'm a Northern Tradition shaman. I've been a shaman for many years. In, when I say Northern Tradition, that means that I work with gods and spirits in the circumpolar, subarctic, Germanic, Scandinavian, Saxon, ancient traditions, most of the shamanic traditions of which are pretty much dead, and it was from spirits that I learned most of it. And I started getting possessed by spirits, not in the sense of something evil comes into you and tries to use you in bad ways. These were clearly, some of them were deities, some of them were gods, and some of them were, I might say, benign spirits who were trying to teach me things and trying to help me with stuff from my teenage years. And I, at the time, I had no idea what was going on. I'm a neo-pagan. I've been in the neo-pagan community for a very long time. I'm in my 40s now. This will tell you how long ago this was. And at the time, I would go to the neo-pagan folks and the local high priestesses and so forth and say, so what's going on? And they had no clue. Absolutely no idea what to do. Structure of the faith just wasn't that far along yet. And I ended up at an Umbanda house. Umbanda is a South American Afro-Caribbean religion. And I was there for a few months. I didn't stay, but what they did is they helped me out and basically taught me how to be able to reasonably control what was going on, to understand what was going on, and to be able to work with the gods and spirits as allies rather than having an adversarial relationship. And so it went. And many years later, it's an integral part of my shamanic work. And it was not an easy road to get used to giving over my body periodically for small periods of time. But because it's for useful purposes, it's for group ceremony, it's for someone who wants to talk to their patron deity, it's for teaching someone, it's for teaching myself, it's always for a good cause. And Kenaz and I actually, like Kenaz said, we ran into each other at a pagan gathering that Kenaz had come out to see what the neo-pagans were doing. And they had a big drum circle, and I was drumming, and I was drumming with my spirit drum, which probably was a mistake. But Kenaz Wimmer was dancing next to me, and what happened was a spirit got pulled through into Kenaz, and Kenaz was possessed for a few minutes. And afterwards, there was a lot of people who didn't understand what happened, even though nothing bad happened. There was just some little screaming and dancing around. But people didn't get it. And the staff certainly didn't understand what to do or what not to do with someone who's has this happen to them and how to treat them. And we sat down the next day and we're like, you do this? Yep. You do this? Yep. We need to write something for Western people to give them some clue as to what's going on with this, because there's more and more of it happening all the time. And especially in neo-pagan circles, it's happening more often because the old gods are coming back and they want their attention. And people just don't know how to handle it. They don't know what to expect. They don't know how to tell what's real, what's not, what's safe, what's not. So that's why we wrote this. And it is really the only book on the market that's coming at it from a standpoint of, yes, we both believe entirely and completely in the gods and spirits that are doing possession, and not that it's a psychological problem or a social phenomenon or anything. This is real people from in other worlds and dimensions who are really contacting and borrowing bodies. And if that's the case, where do we go from here? Okay. Talking now.
That's a
Raven,
really...
Hang on just a second. Raven, when you're talking, could you slow down just a hair?
Okay.
I know I live in the South and my ears are kind of slow, but they're having a hard time keeping up with you.
Okay. You should try writing with him.
Yeah, Ken has said writing.
Is it
so
Raven, is he a prolific
like,
writer and thinker?
Yeah, he said it was like drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah, you kind of get going sometimes like you're a 33 record running on 45. It's like, what did he say? Yeah, but you got to slow down a little bit for us Southerners. We like to talk a little slower. Our minds wrapped around the ideas. Because you've got some really wonderful things to say, so I don't want anybody to miss any of it. Kenaz, you were going to say something before I interrupted?
Yes. I think it's what Raven had said about, we are the first people who have written a book on possession where we were willing to entertain the, entertain the possibility that, yes, maybe there is somebody coming, like maybe there is something which is entering people's bodies. I mean, there have been, people have treated, the first encounters, like Enlightenment era or colonial era Western world had with possession, their explanation was, this is demonic possession. Then you get after, the Enlightenment, you start getting, this is all a big fraud. This is stuff that these people who call themselves shamans and priests, they're doing this. They're play acting so that they can get money and power out of it. Now, if you know anything about shamanic cultures, play acting for, like, there are far better ways to get power and money than being a shaman, and that's true even in shamanic cultures. It tends to be the kind of job people go out of their way to avoid getting it.
Yep.
You tend to get chosen for it. You know, the next explanation after that was, well, this is obviously mental illness. You know, these people are, you know, these people are epileptic. These people are schizophrenic. I saw one person who tried to explain that Haiti had a big tradition of possession because everybody was malnourished. So it's like, you know, there has to be some logical, scientific explanation.
Yeah, and it happens with the Siberians because of Arctic hysteria, all those long, dark nights.
Yeah, there's these sorts of explanations, and, you know, it's, we were, like, so far as I could tell, we were the first people that were like, okay, the people where we are getting these records from, they believe they're getting possessed by something that comes into them from outside. This is a recurring theme with possessions all around the world. These are people who do it for a living, who've done it for most of their lives, who have learned from people who have done it for most of their lives, where they have been doing this for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years. But yet most of the people who had come in to explore it were like, well, obviously these people don't know what they're talking about. You know, they can't be getting possessed by anything. This is all just a silly superstition on their part. And, you know, to us, first of all, we thought, you know, that's just maybe a little bit arrogant. Maybe these people might know what they're talking about. They've been doing it for thousands of years. They might well know something that we don't know, even though, you know, we have, like, PhDs in anthropology or what have you?
I would say that one of the postmodern, the sort of the newest postmodern explanation, which attempts to be respectful but really isn't, is, well, these people have a particular social role, and they know that in order to prove to the rest of the people in their tribe or whatever that they have the social role, they have to act in this way. And so they convince themselves that to act this way in order to prove it socially, so it has all these sociological reasons for it, which I think a lot of the postmodern intellectuals, they feel that's more respectful. It's not. It's still saying these people don't know what they're talking about, and what they are basing their entire life's work on is not real.
Yeah, you know, I can easily see where hysteria would be used to explain it. You know, here in the United States, we've got a really strong puritanical background that says it's got to be evil. It's evil spirits. You know, if you're looking at spirits as these entities and whatnot, they can't all be evil.
The Elfons are all real. I mean, to be fair, there's an awful lot of possession that goes down that actually is someone having issues of mental illness. I would not say that isn't the case. In fact, I might say that the majority of people who fall on the floor and wave their arms and legs and scream are not actually possessed by anything other than those sock puppets. That real spirit possession is more rare than that. However, it does happen.
I think there's an important difference between saying that, you know, the one thing here is, like, neither Raven nor I would claim that, you know, all possessions are really an example of something from outside coming in, nor would we claim that all possessions are beneficial or that nobody ever fakes a possession. I mean, I think the distinction here would be that we are willing to admit that some of them are real. And it's like, that's actually revolutionary, because very few of the people that have, like, wanted to research the phenomena have even been willing to entertain that possibility.
It's a difficult thing, because to entertain that possibility changes your entire world. It means that you have to have an entirely different view of the universe, and most people are not willing to go there, and you can hardly blame them.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, it is. It's clear back to, you know, Salem and the witch trials. You know, there's always this fear of something evil is going to grab us. And, you know, to get past that for people to even look at the idea is a big jump sometimes. You know, I can think of a dozen people right off the bat that if I even brought this subject up would be willing to, you know, come over with their holy water and pray over me for days.
Well, that comes out of a particular worldview where there's only one spirit that's good and all the others in the universe are bad. I mean, obviously, neither Kenaz nor I come out of a background where that is true.
Yeah.
I mean, I think metaphysically, Raven and I are both, like, I think Raven and I use the term hard polytheists. In other words, you know, we believe that there are numerous gods. We believe that these gods are separate and distinct from each other. You know, these gods and these spirits are not all aspects of one big spirit, that they are, you know, as individual, you know, for example, as Gia Scott, Raven Caldera, and Kenaz Filan are.
I would also call myself an animist as well as a polytheist, in that I do believe that there are spirits in stones, rocks, trees, cities, all manner of things. So.
Well, yeah. Yeah, to say that they don't have them would be a little bit conceited, I think.
I mean, you live in New Orleans. Like, if there's ever been a city that's got, like, its own spirit to it, that one is it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, on the weird scale, the three of us wouldn't even get a rating here, you know. New Orleans is New Orleans, okay? You can be really, really weird and still not be noticeable because you're surrounded by weird. It's a great city. I've lived here about 6 years, I guess. And, you know, it's a great place to explore things. You know, because there's so many different kinds of people that come through here. You know, not only does it have a long history as a port city, but, you know, it's a transitory place. You've got the river going into the Gulf, and you've got the things coming from the Gulf in, and the wind coming from the west. And yeah, you know, New Orleans is a place of transitions, I would say.
It is a very liminal place. It is neither east nor west. It's like either, you know, it's probably closer to being the northernmost Caribbean city than, like, you know, than an American city in many ways. You know, linguistically it's very different, culturally it's very different. Oh yeah, New Orleans is an absolutely magical place. In fact, currently my next book is called The New Orleans Voodoo Handbook, so I'm doing a little work right now on the history of the city. That's been some wonderful research. It's always fun to research New Orleans.
Oh yeah, it's a fun place to live too. So when I come here in the city, you'll have to make sure that you look me up. Yeah,
I will definitely do that. A wonderful place, so long as I suppose the 110 degrees and like 99% humidity. Other than that, it's not bad. But
the month to visit, I'll tell everybody right now, the month to visit is October. That's the month we're least likely to have rain. It's not a high hurricane month. It's not cold. It's not hot. It's a beautiful month.
I'm a cold weather person. I think I'll stay up here.
Cold weather. We do actually get cold weather. No, I say that as I look out the window and I have banana trees growing, but yeah, we get cold weather. Yeah.
No. I live in New England. Nothing down there ever gets cold.
Well, I've often heard that, and then I've heard the same people whining about our cold because it's a different kind of cold. Now, I came from the high plateau in northern Arizona, and
yeah,
it gets cold there. And
that's
I'll
right,
admit,
yeah,
the cold here is way colder, even than that biting wind that would blow for days and days and days. Yeah, this is still much colder. It's like it reaches in and grabs your bones. It's the only way to explain it. Just like the heat is much hotter than the desert. It is. Oh, Lord, it's hotter.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's hotter and it's colder. It's uniquely New Orleans.
Yep, that is a great city. I was there in 2001. I have not been back since Katrina. Like, I'd like to come back and see how the city is recovering from that blast, and I'm you know, keeping my fingers crossed that you don't, like, that we don't see another one hit the city for a while before they get the preparations ready for this time.
We have Bill stirring himself out in the Atlantic and never making up his mind which way he's going to go. One day, 1 minute they're telling us he's going to go up the East Coast. Then they're telling us now he's going to go into the Gulf. So, Bill, if you're listening out there, go up the East Coast. I'm really sorry for everybody on the East Coast, but I just don't want to deal with it. That's the thing about living in hurricane country. You do. You don't wish anybody ill. You just don't want it to in your neighborhood.
Actually, the original build of New Orleans was originally built. The original capital of the Louisiana Territory was around modern-day Mobile, Alabama. They moved the territory to the capital to New Orleans because they felt Mobile was too vulnerable to hurricanes. I mean, some parts of, like, the French Quarter of New Orleans is actually pretty safe in case. I mean, it got a little flooded in Katrina. So the high ground of New Orleans is fine. The problem is, like, after the people built out from the high ground, there's a lot of stuff that's still in the bowl, and of course, the bowl got flooded when the levee broke.
Well, and too, okay, if you look at the maps from the mid 1800s, where people settled was dry land, okay, then. And that's the areas that did not flood during Katrina. To make the equation much more interesting is, since, you know, the mid-1800s and people have been settling and filling, there's also what they call subsidence, and it's sinking. So as they build the levees higher, the city gets lower. That does add to the equation. Now, where I happen to live is along a strip of historically real dry land. So there was no flooding here in my little neighborhood. You know, go 150 yards. Oh yeah, you're flooded. You know, but yeah, if you look at what was settled in the mid 1800s, that's what did not flood. And the original part of the city is what's called the French Quarter.
The old part.
Yeah, so, you know, all these other areas, they were, you know, villages outside the main city. You know, even though, I think without traffic, it takes me less than 10 minutes to get to the French Quarter. I live in Metairie, in Jefferson Parish. You know, once upon a time, that was a long way still, though, because if I was walking it, I sure wasn't going to do it in 10 minutes. But it is. It's an amazing city. You're talking about the Haitian voodoo. We have that here. We had Native Americans here. We had, you know, people from all over the world have always lived in New Orleans. It's got, you know, the African mixed in with the Spanish, with the French, with the Northern European, with the Caribbean, with South American, Asian. I mean, everybody contributed bits and pieces to the city. And over time, our demographics has always been shifting and changing. Post-Katrina, we're seeing an influx of more Hispanics. And so, you know, they're going to make another contribution to the city's culture. You see it shifting in the cuisine and everything else over time. You know, and we are. We're a soup bowl. And when you add, you know, with soup, you always keep adding a little of this and a little of that, now, don't you?
It's actually a very interesting story I had run into with New Orleans. You'd mentioned the Indians, is a woman. This was an African-American woman with some Mohawk ancestry in 1920 named Alethea Anderson, or Leafy Anderson, had a spirit named Black Hawk, who told her, I mean, at this time, there was a huge influx of, like, African Americans from the southern United States to Chicago, to New York. I mean, that was the first great migration. This spirit tells her, you know, no, you have to go to New Orleans and found a church. And, you know, I mean, obviously she's like, you know, huh, what, me? You know, no, I'm in Chicago. People come to Chicago from, like, no, you know, I'm the spirit that looks after the South. You know, my brother White Hawk, he looks after the North. I need to be down South. So she comes down south, and she's getting possessed by this Indian spirit, Black Hawk, and then, you know, he introduces some other Indian spirits to other congregations. And, you know, today you have what's called the Black Hawk Spiritual Church is just an enormously important part of African-American New Orleans. It's, you know, it was very influenced by spiritualism, which was an American movement of that time, which just was enormously, enormously popular and, you know, has really been kind of today written out of history. I mean, I don't think people understand, you know, exactly how important that was. I mean, women's suffrage was largely encouraged by spiritualism. Spiritualism was enormously involved in the abolition movement. There's like a whole thing.
I really didn't realize how much influence spiritualism had on American history. That's not something they include, you know, when you're going through school as part of your history. So to find out that that did have a huge contribution, it was like, well, that's very, very interesting.
That's something, you know, and I think Raven and I had talked about it. I remember, like, Raven, you know, we had both realized, well, why did spiritualism, which in the, you know, early part of the 20th century, there were millions of American spiritualists. I mean, spiritualism was a huge, huge movement, and then it became like just suddenly passé. I mean, there are still people doing spiritualism, but it's nowhere. And I mean, you have to, like, turn of the century, there were literally at one point more spiritualists in America than there were Methodists.
Yeah, after a while, there were too many folks who were frauds and were trying to make a buck on it, and when enough of them were exposed, it kind of fell out of favor. That was a problem.
In terms of women's suffrage,
Susan B. Anthony, who pretty much didn't believe in anything, was invited to some spiritualist gathering by a bunch of female women suffragists who had a bunch of her friends, basically, who were having seances. And some reporter came up to her while she was sitting there, kind of uncomfortably in the ante room, and said, "So, where are you going to go when you die? What do you think is going to happen?" And she said, "When I die, I'm coming right back here to fight for women's rights. I'm not going anywhere." So, that's the words of Susan B.
Woman who wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic was actually written by, like, was a very, very dedicated spiritualist. And I believe, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, was also a very dedicated spiritualist. I mean, and of course, Uncle Tom's Cabin was one of the major factors that started the Civil War.
Yeah, you know, it did contribute greatly to the abolitionist movement.
Because here was something all the spiritualists, like spiritualist churches all over the place, when they started getting in touch with spirits, like pretty much without exception, the spirits would say, you know, these are two things which are very important. We must have the women's right to vote. Women's suffrage is very important. Slavery is an atrocity. America must end slavery. This is, you know, I mean, this. If this was all a fraud, sooner or later you would expect somebody would come up with, like, having a seance where they're saying, well, no, you know, of course slavery is a perfectly wonderful thing, and, you know, this idea of women voting, like, well, that's just silly. But no, these spirits just seem to harp over and over on these two subjects.
It's something, if you wanted to sort of be kept up at night thinking about it, to read the history and think, oh my, how much effect did not just spiritualists but spirits have on rerouting American history? That's something to think about it late at night.
getting back to the whole idea of spiritual possession.
Yep.
You know, part of me goes, how does it work? I mean, really, how does it work? I mean, yeah, I'm having a hard time getting my mind wrapped around the idea of another entity being in control of me and doing whatever while I'm unaware?
Well, one isn't. Some people who are possessed are completely unconscious at the time. It's like your soul gets shoved aside into a little closet, and you go out. You're not there. Then you come back, and so there's a certain amount of missing time situation. And for some people, they're there, but it's kind of like being in the back seat behind safety glass, and everything's seen and heard from a great distance, and you're not the one moving the body. There's different levels of possession, and one of the things that we were very careful to talk about in the book was how to tell. We tried to be honest about the dangers. Sometimes people fake it. How do you know? Sometimes people honestly believe that they are being possessed by a spirit, but they are mistaken. How do you know? If you do actually have a real possession, how do you know the spirit is who and what it says it is? Things like this. There are many different. There's all kinds of ways in which it can go wrong. We tried to be honest about that. We also tried to interview. We interviewed a lot of different people who either were horses or had helped with had been assistance to possession. When we use the word horse, that comes out of the Afro-Caribbean traditions. They refer to the person that is carrying the spirit as the horse, and they say that they're being ridden like a horse. So this is a horse rider metaphor. And we actually have taken, Kenaz and I have taken some heat from people who've read the book and object to the fact that, who feel that the word horse should only be used in an Afro-Caribbean context and never for gods and spirits outside of that tradition, whereas we're using it an umbrella term for any person who is willingly allowing themselves to basically be a limo driver for the spirits. And we use that term horse. You know, Kenaz is a horse, I'm a horse. How it works, from experience, I can tell you it is very much like you get a feeling that you're sort of going underwater, I'm always aware of who it is that's coming, and I can see them. They're made of energy, not corporeal, and they're way bigger than I am usually. Most of who I horse is gods. Occasionally I will horse dead people who are smaller than me, but the gods are way bigger, and they kind of push you aside, and maybe they put you in the trunk, so you're, you know, out like a light, and maybe they put you in the back seat. You can see, but you can't do anything, and you can't really hear anything either, and it goes on for as long as it's been negotiated that it will go on, and then you come back, and usually you feel like you've been run over by a truck.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you need a lot of aftercare. depending on how long it was, who it was, some spirits are an easier ride than others, as Kenaz can tell you.
Yeah, it's some of this, like, what will usually happen with me when I'll feel a possession coming is I will frequently feel some kind of, like, a dizziness followed by, like, a feeling of pressure on the back of your neck, near the point of your head where near where your medulla oblongata is. That seems to be a common thing with a lot of horses, is the spirits come in through the back of your head.
Yep. It's like there's a door there.
There's a door there, like a chakra, whatever, what have you. You feel them coming in. A lot of times for a possessor, it would be like, what will often happen is like, I will be like, you know, why is my body doing this? It's like a feeling of like, you know, well, I am doing these things, but I don't want to do them, but I can't really stop doing them. And what's going on here? It's this feeling like you become like, basically it feels like I'm watching my body from about a foot away. I've been hit with some of the spirits where if they hit you really, really hard, it's like 1 minute you're standing there, you feel the pressure, and then a few minutes later you're like, you know, well, what happened, huh? What, you know, well, you don't remember when you got possessed by Dantor and you drank that half bottle of Florida water. Ah, that's the foul taste in my mouth. That kind of stuff. So you can have stuff like that.
I've certainly had the spirits, especially the gods, the big spirits, have been able to do things with my body that I cannot physically do with my body. I'm getting older. I'm pretty arthritic. I can't run. When they've used my body, they can run, and they can jump, and they can do things, and it's not damaged afterwards. Things that I could not do at all, much less damaging. I have spatial dyslexia, and I can't hit the broadside of a barn. I've had at least one deity who possessed my body like to pick up big axes and just swing them around and never harm anyone and always and never miss, and I could never do that. There's some of them like to drink, and I have colitis, and I can't drink, and they'll drink, and it'll be gone. I won't be intoxicated. I'll have no symptoms except for the taste in my mouth of having had any alcohol because they take it with them.
That has happened to me. I'm a vegetarian. I've had a spirit, like one of my spirits, Harvey, came on me. Somebody handed him, well, first of all, his favorite drink is Piman. That is rum in which 21 Scotch bonnet peppers have been soaked.
Oh.
Harvey drank a big old gulp of that. Somebody handed him a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. He ate several pieces. I mean, if you're not a vegetarian, you might not understand. I mean, if a vegetarian eating a large chunk of meat, if the spirit doesn't take it with him, you're not going to be comfortable for the next 48 hours. It just basically, once you haven't eaten meat for a while, you can't really, like, you eat a large quantity of meat, your gut flora has changed. You don't really have the stuff in your stomach to digest it, so it just sits there like a large lump. Didn't happen. I mean, it's like, yeah, I've seen things like that, like possessions. I'm trying to remember one. I saw an older Haitian guy. He was probably about, I'd say, 5'5", maybe weighed 125, 130 pounds. He got possessed by a bull spirit, Bosu. In the Haitian voodoo possession, one of the things you do, you remove the person's shoes so their feet can be touching the earth. It helps the connection. I went to stop him long enough to pull his shoes off. Bosu threw me up on his shoulder and began sprinting around the room. I outweigh this guy. At that time, I probably was around 100, like, you know, about 170 pounds. You know, I outweighed him by a good 20, 30 pounds. He picked me up like I was nothing. At this point, another person runs over to help him. This guy, Toto, was about, like, you know, 6'5". I mean, literally, this was one of the largest men in the group, probably 275, like, to 280 pounds. The guy is really, really large. He grabs, like, Hector at this time, who's got Bosu, tries to stop him. Bosu throws Toto up on his shoulder and does a loop lap around the peristeel with both of us on his arm, on his shoulders. At this point, he's still holding on to me. I can't get down. I mean, he's got me, he's running around, like, making snorting bull noises. I'm just sitting here going, oh, Jesus, get me down, get me down. At this point, my reality tunnel has just gone, like, sproing. I mean, you cannot explain this as this is play acting or this is psychology. You know, this is a guy who has, like, you know, probably close to a quarter ton on his shoulders running around like he's got nothing. I've seen people who've gotten myonate jump in fires. I've seen people pick up burning logs and start eating the embers, and they didn't get burned. I mean, these are not, you know, this is not a parlor trick here. There's something else going on. It's like, if these people aren't possessed, something is happening that is allowing them to do things which basically violate the laws of physics.
There's also that if you're the sort of person who has the sight and you can see auras, for example, or you can see, or even strongly sense psychic things, you can tell. People who are sensitive, when they go to their first, when they go to some place where there is a controlled possession, like a god possession or something like that, and they come face to face with a person who is carrying, for example, a god or a goddess, if they're a sensitive sort, if they're the sort who can see these things, they come away saying, "Oh my God, that was not human. That was way different. That was way bigger than human." And they describe them differently because there's different spirits, but it's usually this, oh my God, that soul wasn't human. That soul was not that person who was there before and who was there after. And it's been described as a human being has got an aura about, oh, say, coffin-sized around your body, and spirits can have bigger auras, and some of the really big ones can be, you know, many feet across, like an enormous light, and some or an enormous darkness if it's more of a death or underworld deity. And at least one really, really old one has been described as, it's sort of as if the deity's little finger was in that person and they were the entire field. They were sort of rotating around them the entire field. So people who are sensitive, they can see it, they can feel it, and that's how you tell if someone whether someone's doing it for real is you get a bunch of folks who are reputable, in reputable spirit workers of whatever sort, hopefully preferably from and who don't all know each other or from different traditions, and you have them come and observe and say, so what do you see? Is this person, is there somebody bigger there or not? And I can certainly see it. I can definitely see it, and I can feel it. Sometimes it being near someone who's possessed is like it feels like sitting next to an electric fence. You're not touching it, but you feel that your skin prickles and your hair stands on end.
Yeah, that is, I was going to use that exact analogy. I mean, or it feels like you're near a thunderstorm. There's a feeling of just really, really intense energy. I mean, once you've actually seen a few actual possessions, it's pretty easy to tell the difference between like an actual possession and somebody who's trying really, really desperately hard to get attention.
Yeah.
There's a feeling about it. There's like, you know, there's also spirit.
Somebody who's crazy and has multiple personality issues, the aura can change when someone's with personalities, but it doesn't change from human to, oh my God, that's so not human. It's still just sort of flavors of human.
I don't remember which one of you it was. You talked in the book in the early parts about having spontaneous possessions occur.
Yeah.
That's Raven.
You know.
Yeah.
How would a person know that's what was going on and that they weren't having some sort of a mental breakdown?
I was worried. I was definitely worried at the time, except that there didn't seem to be any continuity to it. I thought about, gee, was this MPD? Well, no, because it doesn't seem to, no matter what I do, I can't remember these missing time things. And not only that, but they matched with, when I finally went and did research, they matched with specific spirits. It was who I didn't know anything about at the time. And I know I've been checked out by therapists, and I'm sane. And I have no other symptoms of mental illness. And eventually I just came to terms with the fact that I think some people have already kind of have the hole in the back of their head, and are in danger. I think it's something you're born with in a lot of ways. People who don't have that can be occasionally possessed, but it's harder. But people who are wired for it, if you will, who have particular type of brain and they're just wired for it, it's like you're born with the phone, you know, and so they're going to call you. And maybe you didn't know you had the phone and you didn't want to have the phone and you didn't agree to this, but that's too bad. You're the one who's got the phone, so they're calling you. And the best thing you can do is to make what alliances you can to keep yourself safe and to keep it, to make it so. What I did is I said, if you need to borrow my body, first of all, you have to go through my patron deity. My boss is the goddess that I serve, and she keeps me safe. And secondly, you have to make an appointment. Let me know what it is that you want, how you want it done, who you want there, and so that I can do you honor properly, and so that it won't be a big, ugly mess. And I think that the spirits, most of them would prefer that. They would prefer that one sets up a special day and time for them, and you wear the special clothes, and you have the special food ready, and you have assistants to help out so that everything goes okay, and they are there to do work. They're there to do particular things, whatever that is, and it's not you know, they don't come on to you when you're online at the deli and it's going to be an ugly mess. Most of them, they didn't want that. They want it done right.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of wondering about that because you do talk about how these God spirits expect respect and you know, to reverence. And you're dictating to them they have to make an appointment didn't necessarily sound like it was going to be well received.
Well, it's a matter of sometimes it isn't, but it's a matter of saying, look, this is the only way that we can do this to properly honor you. Because I have a relationship with my own patron deity so that I can't just be grabbed and used, they'd have to go through her, and so I'm not a public utility in that way. If they want, they have to deal with her in order for me to be able to use me so I'm kept safe, which means they kind of have to make an appointment with her, and she kind of lets me know, okay, at this particular gathering or holiday, so-and-so would like to make an appearance. What can you do about that? I think that while they may not like it, the gods that we work with, they're incredibly powerful, but they're not all powerful. There are rules and laws of the universe that they have to obey. And as long as we are aware what those rules are, just like we have to obey the laws of physics, we can certainly make them abide by those rules.
I would add that in most possession traditions, there is possessions take place within a structure. If you see a voodoo ritual or if you go to like an Afro-Caribbean thing, you'll be like, okay, well, we got a bunch of drumming. There's people running around here, and then all of a sudden one of them starts flailing, and then everybody starts acting like they're possessed. You know, this is complete chaos. And no, it's not chaos at all. There's a very, you know, once you get like, you know, there are certain rhythms which are used. There are certain offering tools which are made. It's the spirits generally in voodoo, if a spirit possesses you involuntarily, you know, out of nowhere, when just, you know, there's going to be, it means one of two things. One is there's something that's just incredibly important that that spirit has to do right then that they cannot wait for another party. It's very, that's rare. The other one is that you need to get your spirits under control. There are rituals you could take. There's called a lave-tete or a head washing, which you can use. A lot of times somebody who's getting a lot of involuntary possessions will go in and become initiated to get those under control. When you are initiated, you get much more control over your possessions. They become a lot smooth. They can become a lot smoother. You tend to get possessed more frequently.
Yeah,
so it's like there is like there, you know, they, you know, it's not so much a matter of you are telling the spirits, you know, well, look, large, major, big god, you know, you have to do things my way or else. It's more like the gods are coming and, like, we need to get in touch with our congregation, you know. Can you set something up so we can do that?
And I would say 99 times out of 100, if you say to, hey, Mr. Big God, Mr. Nature God or whatever, okay, you want to come, we can either have you pop in on me randomly and it'll be a mess and people won't understand and your message will not be received, or we can make a date and we can do it upright and we'll honor you in all the right ways. Which would you prefer? 99 times out of 100, they'll say they'll prefer to make a date and have you do it right and be received in the way that they would want to be received. And then at the 100th time, that's probably a trickster god, and that's its own problem.
I was just about to say, and the 100th time, it's Loki.
Yeah. Or Coyote, or something like that.
Yeah.
But, I've been watching the neo-pagan community for many years, for decades now, and it has, just in the past 10 years, it's become more prevalent in the neo-pagan community, and we're talking accidental possessions. I mean, the story that we start the book off from was a story that I heard from a pretty traditional Wiccan coven. They were doing a thing that's called drawing down the moon, where I would say it's not a full possession. It's like the energy. You're sort of invoke a deity, and the energy comes through you. But this time they decided to call a specific goddess, and they called Athena. And they were a group that worshipped what they call sky-clad, meaning naked, all naked in a circle in someone's basement. And Athena actually showed up and took the body of the high priestess, and the first thing she said was, "Why am I naked?" And she bitched them out and left. And if you actually read her history in mythology, Athena's never shown naked. It's disgraceful. And she has fancy, elaborate, embroidered clothing. And so it was a case of they didn't know what was going to happen. They thought it was just going to be a little invocation. They didn't realize an actual goddess was going to show up, and they had no way of properly doing her justice and doing her honor. And I've seen this sort of thing happen more and more with accidental possessions, and that's part of why we wrote the book, to say this: people need training in this. You need to know what to do if this happens.
Well, yeah, it would be a little unnerving to have, some sort of ceremony going on and then an accidental possession occurs. It would be unnerving for the person that's being possessed as well as those that are attending with that person.
Yeah, and also it's hard for the person, not just because it's crazy making for them, but also because if no one else believes that's what's going on, you come out, you pass out, you come to, and people are yelling at you for what you did. You have no idea what happened. Then getting blamed for the God walked up to someone and told them something true that they didn't want to hear, and now you're being yelled at. How did you know that? How did you know that? That's rough. That's a difficult thing.
Yeah. I do have a question from the virtual auditorium, though. And that question is, what do you think about the possibility of all the stories of Greek and Roman gods actually being spiritual possessions?
We actually, I think there is definitely something to that. One of the problems when you read a lot of the stuff about the Hellenic cultures and about the Roman cultures is, there was, for a long time, this belief that possession was something that, quote, primitive, unquote, people did. Typically, that would mean sub-Saharan black Africans did. Obviously, the Greeks and the Romans were at the pinnacle of civilization, so they were much too civilized to be doing anything superstitious like possession. But yet, you'll read all these, stories, I want to say it's in the Odyssey where, Zeus shows up disguised as insert a warrior here to give a warning. Zeus showed up, dressed like, Zeus showed up disguised as, Diogenes.
In the Odyssey, actually, yes, Athena shows up disguised as a mentor, this old teacher, to talk to Odysseus' son. And we've wondered about that. Is that a possession? Is it just that mentor was there and Athena said, "I can use you," and slid in and said, "My kid, I got to talk to you." There were lots of, we don't know. There's no way to tell. And if you bring it up and you say, maybe this was possession, maybe that was an instance of possession, the Bacchanalia, for example, the Dionysian revels, quite possibly various sorts of possession. But, of course, we have no proof. It's quite possible, but we can't tell for sure.
Yeah, at this point, it would definitely be speculation.
Yeah.
But, you do look at it, and you can't help but wonder.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, it was far less uncommon for people to have quote unquote seen their gods embodied in a human body back in ancient times. People knew about the phenomenon then, and regardless of whether it was common or rare for their particular area, they'd heard about it and they knew that it happened, and they just sort of accepted that it was something that occasionally happened. The gods needed a human voice to speak with and a human face to look at people with, and so they would borrow someone, usually a priest of that deity, but sometimes someone random that had an affinity for them for some reason.
Okay. Yeah, you know, the whole idea of possession and what you're talking about in your book, Drawing Down the Spirits, is much, much different than the idea of possession put forth in you know, movies like The Exorcist.
Well, if you're trying to discredit an entire religious tradition, what better way than to dwell on the few times that it goes badly?
I might also, the thing with The Exorcist is, like, my main complaint with The Exorcist wouldn't necessarily be that things like that never happen. It's more like that there are positive possessions. I mean, I do think one thing that people who are going to work with possession need to be aware of is that the spirit world is not an entirely benevolent place. There are spirits that like human beings. There are spirits that really don't like human beings or see us as food. There are a lot of other spirits who really don't give a toss about us one way or the other. And you can get in contact with a spirit that is parasitic, that is destructive. And, you know, if you just open up, like, if you just put a for rent sign on your head and say, well, like, I'll let in anything that wants to come in, that's really not a good idea. That's kind of like loaning your car keys to any random stranger.
Yeah, well, guys,
because we've got to go to break right now. So, folks, stay tuned to the Paranormal Radio Network and the Dawn of Shades. We'll be right back with our guests, Raven and Kanaz.
Thank you. Hi. You've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We'll go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for the Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner.
Hi, this is James Atha Yanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth via the path of non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter on its own merits and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality, all without pre-drawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings here. No pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or the highway attitudes. But there are no free passes given either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. The lack of contradiction is the final judge here. On Feet to the Fire.
Feet.
Sunday evenings.
To fire.
How do you listen?
Fire.
www.feettofire.com for more information.
3, 2, 1. Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the skies,
wondering if there's something out there?
In fear of things going bump in the night?
District Radio brings you headfirst into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Hi everyone, Trey Sheridan speaking. Come join us for the program, A Global Focus, every Monday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, where we'll discuss the full spectrum of ufology and related topics. Hope you'll be listening.
Get your dose of truth with the Truth Hurts Radio Show with your host Charles Giuliani, Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. The truth hurts, ignorance kills.
Do you like to ask questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
UPRN 105 is about to get a little darker. Dark Plains Radio Show is coming to UPRN 105. Don't miss your flight into the unknown.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Hello, this is Alejandro Rojas with UFO Think Tank Radio. There are a lot of great shows on the UFO and Paranormal Network, and I am so happy to be added to the list. I've got some wonderful interviews with some great researchers, and you're going to love my show. I know it, people. So check it out, UFO Think Tank Radio.
When it comes to the oil crisis, we are all passengers on the Titanic. With global oil production peaking and demand steadily increasing over the long term, oil prices will soon be back to the levels of last year and even higher. If we stay on the current path, we will hit the iceberg. Hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are the solution to the oil crisis. They are the only technology that can be scaled up globally and meet customer requirements for driving range, fueling time, cost when mass produced, extreme weather performance, and trunk and passenger space. While the hydrogen to power these vehicles will initially come from natural gas, this is better than gasoline and only a bridge to hydrogen from wind and solar. Major car companies have hundreds of hydrogen fuel cell vehicles on the road today, and they will be arriving at dealerships by 2015. But the hydrogen fueling infrastructure needs to be built. Contact your members of Congress today and tell them to start building the hydrogen fueling infrastructure now. Give our planet a break and America back its future. Brought to you by AmericansForAHydrogenEconomy.org.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, I'd like to remind everyone to visit the website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Excuse me. Sign up for the newsletter, wander around and explore the website, let me know what you think of it. You'll find links to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you have a question that you would like to have asked, you can mail it. To email it to me at giascott@gmail.com. I'm still monitoring the email during the program with Raven and Kanaz tonight, and I'm trying real hard not to miss anything. So, Raven, Kanaz, you both still with me?
Yep, I'm here.
Good. That's always a good start. And we were rapidly running off on a topic when I had to, like,
I'd actually like to pick up where we left off. We were talking about negative possessions. And I've had to deal with my share of them because part of my shamanic work is pulling those out of people. I wouldn't call it exorcism. I sort of reach in and yank them out if I can. But generally what I find, if it's real, which it mostly isn't, mostly it's someone with mental problems, but when occasionally it's something real, it's usually a much smaller critter than you'd think. It's some critter that's floating around and likes to feed off of people. And if they get into somebody, then they basically sit there and they feed off them, and they feed off the negative reactions of the people around them. And what I've found, strangely enough, is that in most cases, there's consent going on. In fact, I might even say all cases with the sort of thing. Some part of that person's psyche, whether that's usually it's some sort of part of their psyche that they've sort of locked in the unconscious in the basement, and it's not getting its needs met, and these critters sort of show up at the basement door and give them lots of promises, and they open the basement door and let them in. So there's some kind of conscious or unconscious consent going on to do this. And you yank them out and you toss them away, and if there's still consent, they just come right back. If the person still has a vested interest in that, even if the person is protesting, often it's like, look, you need to go and talk to the dark parts of your psyche, talk to the parts of yourself that you've banished, because they're in league with this. That's usually what happens with negative possessions. They're pretty rare. But when they do happen, it's because some part of the person is letting them in, basically. And that's hard for that person to hear.
So, okay, when you're, you know, involved in a spontaneous possession, how do you determine whether or not this is a negative one or not? Assuming it's real, how do you know the difference between a negative one and a positive one? Because
what are the effects of the possession? How does the possession impact the people around you? How does it impact the person? Like, what is its impact on the person who's being possessed? If you've got something like, you know, somebody is getting possessed and it's like, okay, and I've lost 30 pounds in the past 6 weeks. You know, I look like, you know, I don't look good. My friends are leaving, like, my friends don't want to be around me anymore. They say they can't they don't recognize me. A lot of times for me, somebody who has something negative attached to them, they feel wrong. They feel, I mean, it's sort of like, the best way I could describe it is, it feels like being next to a large rotting animal. It feels like there's, like, it feels like decay. It feels like wrong. It's like, it makes, like, if you're ever around somebody who, like, just makes your skin crawl for no, a lot of times, like, people who are being, like, you know, have something like that that's attached to them or riding around, they always feel like they need a shower, even if they just stepped out of the shower. I mean, that's the best. It's like they feel wrong.
If it's a
Look, you know, when I met those people in my life, and the way I always describe it, it's like my skin gets up and leaves, and there I stand naked with no skin. I mean, they really made you feel slimed. You know, that might be why.
Yeah, I mean, and it could be just them. You know, it's not always that, but that's certainly a great place to start.
Okay.
If it's a spontaneous possession, say, in the middle of a drum circle somewhere, I can see them. So for myself, I rely on my sight, capital S sight. And I'll look over there and say, is that something that doesn't look like it ought to be in human body? And if it is, I'll usually try to see what it looks like. And I can, and what it feels like, possession by a dead person, which feels different from possession by a nature spirit, which feels different from possession by a parasitic predatory spirit, which feels different from possession by a god. They feel different. They smell different. Here I'm sort of talking in through synesthesia. I'm using feel, smell, see, when really these are not physical senses at all. But they translate themselves to your physical senses. I think anyone can sort of get a feel for, certainly after a while, after having seen a few possessions, you can get a feel for, what does this smell like? What does this feel like? What is this, how does my body react? I think that's one of the big deals, is how does my body react? My body reacts a specific way when there is a God present. And in fact, that's how people say, well, how do I know if what's talking to me is a god or if it's the sock puppets in my head? You look at how your body is responding. My body responds a specific way for whether there's a God present, whether they're in a human body or not. It responds a different way if there's somebody who's dead around, a ghost or some a dead soul. And if you've been around these things enough, you can look at your body and say, how is it responding? And that's your gauge. At least that's how I've found a useful way to gauge it.
Uh-huh. And we do have a question from the virtual auditorium, and that is, when a person is possessed, where is that person's own spirit?
Shoved to the side. Usually it's still in there. It hasn't left anywhere. Some folks say that that their spirit goes somewhere else when they are God-possessed, but for me, I'm still in there. It's just like the metaphor I sort of think of it in my head as a car is that I got shoved out of the driver's seat, and maybe I'm in the passenger seat, and maybe I'm in the back seat, and maybe I'm in the back seat behind safety glass, and maybe I'm in the trunk, but I'm still in the car.
Okay.
So, and in fact, when you come back from it, I often find I have this weird feeling of having been squished in some way, I don't want people really close to me. I'm a little claustrophobic for a bit, because I get this feeling of having been packed down, and so I'm like, give me space.
That's interesting. So, okay, you have these possessions, and assuming that these possessions are real and they're being coordinated and they're happening within, the confines of the overall experience with the drum circle and everything, and everything's kosher with all that, what is the real benefit to going there?
What's the point of bothering?
Yeah, what is the point? Really, for us, what is the point of us letting one of these entities possess us for a period of time?
Well, I can say, once somebody has actually seen a genuine possession where, like, a god or a spirit has come into somebody and they've actually experienced it firsthand, you will never again mistake a god for an archetype or a symbol.
I think it's a strong sense of religious awe. Very definitely. I'm sorry, Ken, go on.
Yeah, there's this feeling of awe. It's a very direct connection with the divine. Once you've experienced, I think that experience can be worthwhile. It's like when you come to it looking for that experience, I think it can be a beautiful, it can be a magnificent experience. It can be like a very life-changing thing.
I think
When I saw the Grand Canyon, that was very awe-inspiring, and you did have a very big sense of the divine and the vastness of the Grand Canyon. But that doesn't mean I want to go to the Grand Canyon every week or every year.
I don't want to be possessed every week or every year. but people go to church every Sunday. Many people go into a house of God every week, and while they probably don't have a strong religious experience, every week, they, on some level, they hope to. Certainly, I don't think that possession is something that needs to be done regularly. It's, for nothing else, it's hard on the horses. But it does, it really does create, most people can't talk to God or gods. Well, they can talk to them, but it's rare that they get a clear answer back, like a conversation. Most people do not hold two-way conversations with their gods. They would like to. I remember an interview with a very famous nun who they asked her what the hardest part of her calling was, and I guess they expected her to say celibacy, but actually what she said was God's silence. And I have been able to carry a god or a spirit for someone who desperately needed to talk to that deity or that spirit, because that deity or spirit was a strong part of their lives. And I was able to carry it for them, and they were able to touch that in a real way. And they were always really pleased and really grateful. When I've done this for communities, when I've done this as an example, a friend of mine who's also a horse, the two of us carried for a large public event a pair of gods who are married to each other, so a married couple of god and goddess. And afterwards, while we were recovering, people were coming up to us and saying, that was wonderful, that was amazing, thank you so much for allowing me to come that close to my gods and look them in the eye and feel their energy and have them speak to me. People were really moved and really touched, and that makes it all worth it. That makes it every bit of it worth it.
Go
ahead.
No, I was going to say, yeah, that has actually been my experience. Is it's, you know, being around, like, seeing a possession is just a really awe-inspiring experience. I mean, it's, I will also say, one thing we've discovered, you do have to have a little care with the audience, because, like, it may be an awe-inspiring experience for 99% of the people there, and then you have one idiot that decides that this is a complete joke.
Or one
and they will start
really
disrespecting.
Yeah. One person's really uncomfortable with the whole situation and uncomfortable with the way that they are made to feel by the presence of the spirit, and so they act out or become angry or defensive or something like that, which is another reason it's real good to have a structure there where you know who's going to be there, and if you don't know who's going to be there, you've got people to take care of the troublemakers.
Well, you know, I found your book very, very interesting. And, you know, but as I'm listening to you guys talk tonight, I'm kind of going, okay, I really want to know what, you know, you've gone over the minuses, the bad things that could happen, but nobody really talks about why this would happen. I mean, there's got to be a reason for it to happen. You know,
well, the reason
I
really is that certain
today, but it doesn't mean that
gods and spirits like people, and they like people. They are invested in us and our world, and they want to reach out to us, and they want to interface with us. And they are not of the same material level as the people here, and so they need a material interface. And I mean, I don't know how. I think it's one of those numinous things. People say, oh, my God, it was just so amazing, but we can't describe it. It's kind of like that. It's like being near this and being up close to it is beautiful, is amazing, is life-changing, is you walk away from it going, wow. It's a religious experience, and it's a religious experience of a depth and intensity that most people rarely get the chance to touch. And certainly most people in our culture, we tend to be scared of and distrust really intense religious experiences. We discourage that. And,
well, yeah, we've kind of turned our religious experiences into the equivalent of rice cereal compared to real food.
Yes.
You know,
it's
very bland and pre-chewed.
And if all you've ever had is rice cereal and someone hands you fudge brownies, you're going to be like, what the hell is this? But it really
don't
is.
Give me an exception, you know? And maybe that's what, you know, a lot of times that's why people react so negatively, in a sense it's spiritual indigestion. It's the problem.
It's too intense.
You know, we've found with negative, like the people who have, like, you know, said, like, had concerns about possessions, we've had a few things that have come up repeatedly, and you know, a lot of the criticisms that there is some merit to them. I've heard a concern with many people that, well, if you accept possession, sooner or later you're going to get people who are faking it for, you know, power, you know, for sex, you know, the old, like, you know, hello, I am Apollo and I want to sleep with you.
Yeah,
pretend
yeah.
I'm not Joe Nebbish the high priest. I'm really Apollo, really. It's like there was a lot of that fear. There was the fear that people were going to hurt themselves opening up their heads and letting anything in without any kind of proper protection. And, you know, I think both of those are, you know, certainly, you know, valid concerns. I mean, I think there are workarounds for them. I think, you know, with the analogy I give as far as possessions danger is, it's let's say that possession is probably less dangerous than driving a car. Lots of people drive cars every day. You know, people get hurt when they're careless with cars. If you show as much care in dealing with possession experiences as you show on your drive to and from work, you're probably going to be okay. I mean, if you take the spirits as seriously as you take that 18-wheeler in the next lane, they probably won't run over you.
But I think the real answer to what's the point of doing this is really that it's happening. Whether we like it or not, it's happening, and the incidences of it happening are. And since it is happening and it is increasing, we had darn well be ready. We had better get our act together and be ready. So, I mean, yes, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's transcendent, but it's also here. And so saying, well, why do we need to do this? Well, because if we don't, it's going to be on us, and we're going to be utterly unprepared, and that's not going to be good.
Aha. Okay. Now, another question for you guys. See, I told you there wasn't any questions, but I don't write them down. I just think them up as we go.
No problem.
These possessions, you talk about the spontaneous possessions, and where most of us are not involved in any sort of a religious context that allows, let alone encourages, possessions.
Yep, and most people will never see or have an experience.
What other sorts of explanations would people attach to a spontaneous possession that they may have experienced?
That I'm nuts?
Yeah.
That's like a common one. You know, it's, well, I must be mentally ill because, you know, that's an explanation within... people explain anomalous experiences based on, like, the information they have available to them and based on the preconceptions of their culture. In our culture, you know, it's like, all of a sudden, I lost control of my body and, like, you know, I started saying and doing things that were beyond my control. The automatic explanation there is, well, I am schizophrenic or I'm epileptic.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a lot of times you'll find, you know, and to add an extra little layer of complication to that, it's not always a dichotomy. A lot of times people who have mental illnesses really are more sensitive to the spirit world, and really it is easier for them to get possessed. So you then get into the question of how do you distinguish, you know, it's not like, well, this person is mentally ill, so obviously this is a faked possession. It's like, well, no, maybe this person is mentally ill, and that's a genuine possession.
And often,
but
in those cases, often this person is mentally ill, and that's what allowed that parasitic spirit to get in the first place.
So it's like, yeah, that particular break. Sometimes people who have certain, like, one of the things also is, our culture doesn't really have a role for people who, like, we don't really have a shaman role in our culture. I remember reading from a person I knew who was a voodoo priestess, talked about her first ungan, the first person who taught her. And he went through this period where, you know, he spent years, he was, like, sleeping on the streets, he was, you know, he started hearing voices, he started getting possessed. Because this was happening in Haiti, they said, oh, you know, you've been called by the Loa. They put him in the Javo, that they gave him the initiation ceremony, and he went on to become a professional Hungan. If that same thing had happened to him in the civilized, like, you know, advanced United States, they probably would have pumped him full of Thorazine and put him into a hospital because, obviously, you know, he's insane.
Well, it did happen to me. That's exactly what happened to me, actually. And I just didn't tell any mental health people about it, and I managed to keep my... I was never so bad. I managed to keep my shit together enough so that it wasn't an issue that I was able to stay safe until I could get to a point where I was through all the bad parts. There's a certain amount of remaking you that has to happen in order for you to be a proper bridge to the spirits, and that remaking is very painful and very difficult. And if you're all alone and you have no idea what's going on and you have no cultural context, You can die. You can go incurably insane. It can break you. And I have to wonder how many people are dead or in the bin who, in any other culture, they would have been contacted by spirits and they would have been recognized and they would have been handed over to experts who would know how to cushion that for them and how to get them through that hard part. But there was no one. There wasn't even the knowledge of what was going on, and they just thought they were crazy and they got put away, and the spirits, of course, didn't leave them alone and kept at them and broke them. I have to wonder about that. I really do, because but for a great deal of luck and fortune on my part, that would have been me. And instead, I'm a professional shaman, and so but I could have gone there. I could have decided that the spirit contact, which was relentless and would not leave me alone, and to a person who refused to believe in this, they would have considered themselves to be nuts. I refused to believe that. I said, this has got to be something else. And indeed, it turned out to be something else. And I turned out to not be nuts, but be entirely functional with a specific job. If I hadn't decided to make that leap into believing it, I don't even want to think about what would have happened to me, but it wouldn't have been pretty.
I hit something very like that myself. What happened with me was I decided, okay, the voices I'm hearing in my head are, like, I will treat them as real, because my alternative is to treat them as mental illness if I accept that diagnosis for myself. I know that what I'm looking at is a lifetime on disability, probably, you know, interspersed between periods of homelessness and hospitalization. That really, there in our culture, that's what happens to you when you have the disease, which I at that time assumed would be schizophrenia. I figured, okay, I can accept that role for myself. You know, obviously there are professional people who will listen to what I'm telling them and say, yeah, that's obviously the case. Or I can assume that these voices that I'm hearing, you know, this voice that's calling itself Legba, who is the keeper of the crossroads, he's one of the most important spirits in Haitian voodoo, I found out later. I can assume this is Legba and see where that takes me, because I know that the alternative is that I'm essentially giving up on any chance of having any kind of a healthy life or relationship, etc. And it turned out that was the right choice to make. But it was not a choice that would have really been encouraged by many people, you know, in the medical establishment.
Nope. It actually helped me a lot to read accounts of anthropology. It frustrated me, but it helped me. So if you read accounts of anthropology in terms of people in tribal societies where there's the one person that the spirits grab and say, okay, your ass is mine now, and you're going to be the spirit worker, whatever name it is for that particular tribe and area, and they really are, all the accounts talk about that they really are relentless, and it's often not consensual. They grab someone and put them through the mill until they accept the job, and basically you'll do this job or we'll kill you or drive you mad. And reading that this happens all over the world, that people are grabbed by the spirits, and it looks scary at first, but what's really going on is that there's a job to do, and there's necessity. There's absolute necessity for this job, and the spirits are there to help you, but you don't have a choice. You have to do the job, and you have to come to terms with them. Reading that and saying, okay, this is what happened to me. I was a dumb white American. I didn't know anything, and yet it came and got me anyway. But this is something that happens all over the world, and it's normal, or it's rare, but normal and accepted in most tribal societies. And that was incredibly helpful to me, to know that this is a normal way, this is one variation on a normal way for humans to be. It's just not something that we have a place for now.
Now, I got another question for you guys. Assuming that this person is being possessed by, you know, this particular god, and they're telling them whatever they're telling them, How do they know the difference between somebody who's delivering a real message and a trickster?
You mean the spirit's real, but you don't know if they're who they say they are?
Right.
That's a tricky one. One thing that you can do if they say, I am God X, and you are not sure they are God X, you can go find other people who work with God X. You can find other spirit workers who've talked to or been possessed by or something, dealt with real-time God X, and you can say, so, does this sound like God X to you? And if they say, no, totally wrong, if you get, like, several opinions and it's all totally wrong, then you've got something that's like, sure, I'll be God X for lunch. But generally, I would say researching God X can help too. Talking to people who've dealt with that particular God or spirit, and also researching it. What are they like? What is written about them? In some cases, there's so little written that you have no way to tell, and you really got to go to people. But this is where I think comparing notes is really, really important. And I think a lot of folks who do this need to come forward and talk about their experiences. Okay, I've been a priest of God X for 30 years, and this is what God X is like. So if someone comes along with a totally anomalous experience, granted, deities are different for different people, but they're not that different. Somebody comes along and says, God X told me to do this ridiculous, not a character thing, and everybody can sort of shake their heads and say, I don't think that's who you got. So that's my best advice for that. Can I want to weigh in on anything?
Another one that you see a lot in a lot of the Afro-Caribbean traditions, particularly the ones that are derived from the Yoruba stuff, is they will use divination. I mean, it's a running joke among people in voodoo, the people who are into Santeria or Ifa, they're always throwing coconut shells to see what comes up. They're always throwing cowries. Yeah. They're always going to babble out to, like, go to the table of Ifa. And what it is they're looking for confirmation from something, like, they're looking for a neutral third-party confirmation. It's like, well, okay, I had this meeting with, I'm being possessed by something that says it's God X. Well, you go to somebody who's who's a competent diviner. The person can use the I Ching, can use tarot cards, geomancy, horary astrology. There's a whole bunch of different things they can use. They use that, and then you get a result. Oh yes, this definitely sounds like it's God X. Or the person says, well, no, it's not. You get a couple of different opinions, and all of these people are pretty much saying the same thing. Then you can feel a little more confident that you're dealing with somebody who is, like, something that is what it says it is, or somebody, or it's not.
I'd say that it's one of the, as a shaman, I'm a diviner also, and it's one of the top 10 questions that I get. Not so much about possession, but if someone says, there's somebody talking to me in my head, and I think it's a god, and I think it's this god, but I'm not sure. Who is it? That's one of my top 10 questions. So what is this spirit that's talking to me?
So it's a collective, you said?
It's one of my top 10 questions, is people saying, who is this spirit that is talking to me? When I do divination for people, as part of my professional work. That and what am I supposed to do with my life? I think those are probably like the top two.
Yeah, talking to other people that do readings, whether they're psychics or tarot readers or whatever, those seem to be typical topics, along with whether or not they're ever going to find the love of their life. Love's another big one.
I don't get those so much anymore.
You don't, huh?
You don't go to the shaman for that. You go to the shaman when everything is so bad that you think you're going crazy. That's when you come to me.
Okay. Well, obviously, I probably should have called you probably 10 years ago we can laugh about thinking you're crazy. A number of years ago, I had a car accident that I had a severe concussion. One severe enough that the recoil left me blind for 6-8 hours. and then caused severe vision disturbance for a period of time after that. So it was a substantial smack on the head. I went through the windshield of a car. And I was having a lot of trouble with various things. And it was like I was having seizures, but instead of my body having the seizures, my emotions did it. And I was having real severe trouble with short-term memory. And I'd always been one of these people that school work was very easy for. And I was going to college part-time and working full-time. And all of a sudden, I'm failing classes. I go in and take tests that I studied for. I'd never had to study before in my life. And I've studied for these tests, and when I would get the test, I would look at the test. I had no idea what the answers were. So I'm failing. And I'm sitting down, and I'm thinking, okay, which one am I thinking? You know, I'm acting goofy and everything. And I decided I must be crazy. And I thought, well, what does a crazy person do? And I said, well, you know, I think a crazy person's supposed to go see a medical doctor. So I called my doctor, and I made an appointment. To make a long story short, no, I wasn't crazy. I was dealing with the aftermath of head trauma, and all of these things did eventually go away. But, you know, people do. You know, things can happen to you that do make you think you're crazy, even if that's not what's really going on.
Yeah. And
you know, and it's either bipolar or spiritual. Yep. What'd you say again?
And so, and that was an extra, that was a different explanation. You had a physical problem. And I think that having a spiritual problem is just as much an issue as having a physical problem.
And perhaps you go to a physical doctor when you got a physical problem. You know, perhaps, you know, if you're thinking you're crazy, and maybe in its spiritual realm,
you end up on my doorstep.
Spiritual doctor. Pardon?
You end up on my doorstep.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, my only experience with a shaman has been I had one do a healing rather spontaneously when I was visiting Roswell a couple years ago during the UFO festival. And I'd been battling some sort of a chest thing, and I don't know what she did other than when she was done, you know, she said she had to go wash, and she left. And I don't know what was going on, but I was much better afterwards, so I don't know. I don't know what she did. She said it was very yucky. I don't remember her exact words, but that was my soul. I just really didn't have experience with someone that called themselves a shaman, and I really don't know that much about that particular woman. You know, I've known a few medicine men from various tribes and whatnot of Native Americans, which is a form of shamanism too, but I've never engaged them for personal spiritual issues.
Yeah.
You know, then talking to them about various, you know, other things. But yeah, you know, I guess I hadn't thought about, I never thought about possession the way your book presents it. It's always had such negative connotations for me because of the various books and fictional materials that have been put out in, you know, the mainstream over the last, you know, in my lifetime, 40-some years. So, yeah, you know, this is kind of a new idea, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that.
Well, we hope that this will go somewhere. We hope that people will read this and get a new view of possession, that even if they don't believe it, perhaps they'll get a view of what people are really thinking who do believe it, and what can be done respectfully if there are issues that come up in their spiritual group.
Well, yeah, and I'm, you know, by accepting this as a potential, and you know, it may offer, because I've seen some very, very strange things. Okay, I will admit I have never found an explanation for some of the entities that I saw very physical right in front of me. I don't know. You can't explain it through, you know, I wasn't drunk, I wasn't high, I wasn't overtired, I was not hallucinating, I saw it. So, you know, was it a spirit? That may be the only explanation, because it sure wasn't any normal creature. You know, and so, you know, it does open a whole other realm of explanations for the things that I have in my, you know, mental weird crap file. Yep. You know, where you file things that just, I don't know what happened, but I saw it. I experienced it. I heard this. This was real. But what was it? I don't know. You know, and I'm sure that I'm not the only one. Probably many people out there listening tonight are going, you know, maybe that fits what I saw that night and or that day or whatever, because a lot of times we think spiritual things only happen at night. That's not true, folks. Spirituality can happen any time of the day.
Yep.
So we're nearing the end of the show now. Are there some things that you want to make sure people, you know, one thing that you haven't told people is where to get your book, what your websites are.
I am at kenazfilin.com, and I believe Raven is cauldronfarm.com.
I've got several websites. The one people probably want to look at is northernshamanism.org. The book is available on Amazon also if people want to look for it there. And it's out through Inner Traditions.
Yep, it's available everywhere. And folks, if you can't remember Kanaz Falan or Northern Shaman or anything else,
if you want to find me, just do a Google search on my name. My website will come up.
And we've got a page up on the guys on Exogeny Network, so they're there. And with a few more minutes left, what are some thoughts you want to make sure that you leave the audience with?
Buy the book. Okay, well, other than that, I mean, I would say if you are experiencing possession or you feel like you are, I would say definitely get in touch with me or with Ray and or with Raven. You know, I can't guarantee you we're not, you know, I can't guarantee you that we're going to tell you, oh, yes, you are possessed. You know, we are going, you know, we will be, reasonably skeptical about it. You know, we're going to try to exhaust other explanations. But, you know, if you are getting possessed, try to talk to somebody who knows something about it. If it's not me or it's Raven, you know, a lot of people in the neo-pagan or the Wiccan scene have been working with the Afro-Caribbeans, going to Umbanda houses or to Santeros or attending voodoo societies, because they have a context. It's like, okay, this is happening to me. It's like, okay, yes, we've seen this. We know what to do with, you know, we know what to do with it. You know, it's, if this is happening, it is serious. You know, they're like, you know, you need to address this issue. You need to ascertain, you know, that this is indeed the issue, that you're not dealing with some kind of, like, that you're not dealing with a brain, with a neurological issue, that we're not dealing with a psychiatric issue, and that, like, you know, once we ascertain this is a spiritual situation, we then have to figure out, why are the spirits possessing you? What do the spirits want? I guess Raven would probably add some stuff to that.
I will not diagnose possession over the internet or the phone, so do not ask me to. You'd have to make an appointment to come to Massachusetts and let me take a look at it. But the point that I'd like to leave people with is that possession does not, being possessed does not make you special. A negative possession does not make you special. It does not give you a chance to shock your parents. It just makes you sick and can really screw you up. A positive possession, while it can be beautiful and transcendent, is fundamentally a service situation. You are not special. You are just the limo driver. And anyone who thinks that whether it's that either or any kind of possession is all special really has no idea what they're talking about and probably should stay away from it at all costs, because it doesn't. It's at its best. It is amazing, but it's all not about you. Totally not about you. You're just a votive object. And at its worst, it can really screw you up. So it is not something to be approached with, I can do this and see how cool all my friends will think I am, or my first affinity or whatever. No, do not go there with that attitude, because if it's a positive situation, if it's a positive God or spirit, they can see all that and they will teach you a lesson and break your pride.
Okay. Guys, okay. We have run out of time. So I want to thank both of you, Raven and Kanaz, for joining
us
tonight. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Yes. I've enjoyed the program tonight, and I hope all of you have as well. And I hope that you also found that it provided plenty of food for thought with more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we bring you Victor and Cooch Daniels, author of Matrix Meditations, a 16-week program for developing a heart-mind connection, and one more fascinating episode of The Dawn of Shades. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.